Detsana, on the 7th of November, 1979. The reason why some practitioners are confused and in a mess is because they do not practice following the Dhamma. If they practice following the Dhamma, how then could the sasana degenerate and diminish in strength? The only weakness is in the followers of the sasana. They are the ones that regress and become worse, for the sasana dhamma is still unchanged. It is therefore imperative that when we live together, we are careful and vigilant. We must not allow the kilesas to accompany or direct our conduct and behavior, and our reaction to one another when we come into contact. This can create conflict and friction between ourselves. At least, it can cause resentment, and at worst, division and schism. When this resentment becomes the aramana of the heart, then it will be difficult for us to do the practice of bhavana. This is the crucial point. It is good if each one of us is possessed with Dhamma inside our hearts, being intent on Dhamma, the truth, and what is right and proper, and not allowing the selfish kilesas that are so deeply embedded within the heart to arise and destroy the excellent and valuable Dhamma. If we can maintain this, it is great. But why can't we do it when these things are of such a gross nature? Living amongst friends, it can be determined by discussion who is right and who is wrong. As we are all grown-ups, when someone talks or acts in a way that is contrary to the Vinaya or the Dhamma, it will be obvious to all of us. So when we all know about it, then we should be able to give and take warning and admonishment. This will accord with the spirit of Bhavarana, to allow ourselves to be corrected and admonished. This is what we do every year on the last day of Pansa, the rain's residence, when we say, Sangham Pante Bhava Remi. Oh brother, I put myself up to be corrected and admonished by the Sangha. Therefore, we can warn and admonish one another as we allow our friends to correct us. But if our invitation for criticism is merely perfunctory, then it will be of no benefit, apart from merely casting the image of a bhikkhu that is totally devoid of any real substance or value. To display the fact that one is a bhikkhu is not the true quality of a bhikkhu who is intent on truth and Dhamma. When we go forth with the true aspiration for the truth and Dhamma, then there is no chaos and trouble or dukkha. This is unlike the way of the world in general, for there are all sorts of factors that contribute to clashes and conflict of interests in livelihood, work, employment, and business. Furthermore, there is also the struggle for influence and power. Consequently, the strife and friction becomes infinite and overwhelming. However, with us bhikkhus, we are not affected by these things, for we are concentrating on uprooting and cleansing those things that are the cause of the trouble in the world discussed above. We are eradicating them every day. When we go through dukkha, it is for the purpose of uprooting instead of accumulating those things that will produce more dukkha. The dukkha that arises from being vigilant and restrained, the mastering of the heart, and the disciplining and suppression of each different kind of kilesa is inherent with the one who is going to transcend dukkha. It is imperative that one must contend with dukkha, and as a natural consequence of that, one will also have to experience dukkha. But this kind of dukkha is not for the arising of the kilesas that will accumulate more dukkha for us, for it is for the arising of Dhamma that will bring us happiness. The Lord Buddha served as an excellent example in going through dukkha. There should not be any doubt about this. Had the Lord not contended with dukkha and transcended both the dukkha of the body, which is the external dukkha, and the dukkha of the heart, which is the internal dukkha, then he would not have been able to be the Sāsadā teaching the world. It was the same way with all of the Savakas. They all, similarly, had to shoulder the burden of dukkha arduously and contend with it as they cultivated the way. They each successively attained to the fruits of Sōdāpanna, Sakadāgami, Anāgami, and ultimately to the fruit of Arahantship in this and that place. They never relented or backed down. They had to experience dukkha steadily, right from the beginning stages, in the work of uprooting the kilesas. In other forms of work, there isn't that much opposition. But in the work for the eradication of the kilesas, it is the kilesas that oppose the Dhamma. Sometimes we cannot even withstand them, but have to fall for their tricks that deceive and mesmerize us, completely putting us to sleep, with ourselves being totally unaware of it. This occurs to many people. For this reason, we have to investigate and examine in our exertion in all postures. Sati is extremely vital. We must always be in possession of it. When we bring to mind any particular Dhamma object or any condition, we must be aware of them right within ourselves. The Lord called this sampajanya. Controlling this concentration is one form of dukkha. We have to keep sati to be with ourselves, and we have to be aware right within ourselves by turning this awareness inwards towards ourselves. Then we will be aware within ourselves. Sati is the thing that holds the awareness, drawing it inwards. When there is no sati, then this awareness will be sent outwards. Then this body will be like a dummy, totally devoid of any awareness. All of the awareness will be sent outwards. This outward-going awareness of the various train of thoughts, speculations, and flights of fancy, due to the lack of sati, to direct and take care and drag it back, is harmful to the heart. This is because it rounds up those things which are damaging and poisonous to the heart and are constantly burning it. The kilesas never weaken. They are never lazy, and they never cease to amass themselves. For one who cultivates Dhamma, there is always a time when he is weakened, and also a time when he is strengthened. This is the case in the beginning stages. The kilesas, however, never become weak, not until the time our sati, panya, satta, and diligent effort are steadily developing and increasing in strength and power. Then the opposition that we are contending with steadily diminishes. That is when the kilesas become steadily weakened. The kilesas become weakened due to the power of Dhamma. It is the Dhamma that hits, strikes, punches, and cuts down the kilesas, causing the kilesas to steadily expire and dissolve away from the heart. The opposition to Dhamma will then become less until the kilesas have been totally obliterated from the heart. No more will there be those things that will turn the heart against Dhamma. And since this Dhamma and ourselves will be one and the same thing, then there will be nothing to turn the heart against ourselves as well. I would really like to have my fellows in Dhamma attain to knowledge and insight. I would really like to see this happen, befitting the intention that I have in teaching and instructing my friends. I have been doing this for some time, and have been concentrating all of my strength and energy into it. Regardless of what level of Dhamma it is, I have never kept its secret from you, and I have never hidden the way of practice from you. I have always stressed and have always been ready to bring to light any part of the Dhamma that can be of benefit and a lesson for you. This is because I want my friends to be firm and resolute with their practice and exertion for the satisfying results, like all the various teachers have experienced. Let these results come about due to your own exertion. Be tough and strict with yourselves. Let your dogged determination and wise judgment assist and support you as you progress along the path. This is what I like to see, for I have given a lot of thought to these things, and have successively verified them from the beginning stages of the Dhamma practice. As soon as the Dhamma, which is the state of calm and coolness, has entered into the heart, one immediately sees its value. The happiness that it imparts is a lot more weighty than any other kind of happiness that one has experienced in the past. Just having realized the state of calm is enough to make one see the worth of oneself and the harm of all confusion and chaos. Be enthusiastic and keep on intensifying your effort in your practice. The happiness and magnificence of the citta will emerge so that you can clearly experience them. One will now come to see the harm of the kilesas that one had not been able to perceive in the past. Such is the way that I practiced before. There are two different characteristics of the citta concerning the state of calm and coolness. But for most people, about 95% of them, the coolness and calm will be of a general nature, where one can withdraw from that state any time that one likes to. This is generally the case with most practitioners. This is the kind of characteristic common to most people. The other 5% are a lot more extraordinary than the rest. If it converges, it will do so suddenly, like a person falling into a well or falling down an abyss. Once it has converged, instead of remaining in that state, it will go wandering about in the heavens and hells. These are the two types of citta. The latter must depend on an experienced teacher to really assist it, or else it can go to ruin. The 95% group can progress along simply and smoothly, without being exposed to any danger. When it enters into the state of calm, the citta should be left to remain in that state. Once it has withdrawn, it is now suitable for the work of investigation. One must not be complacent. The uprooting of every type of kilesa must be done with panya, and not by samadhi. Samadhi only rounds up the kilesas inside, and causes them to calm down. Once one rounds up the kilesas, but does not cure them, then they will not die. As soon as samadhi becomes weakened, then the kilesas will become active and aggressive. Furthermore, the aramana that are more powerful than samadhi can agitate that samadhi. But if one uses panya, then one will steadily understand, and the kilesas will steadily disappear. This is the way that it will subsequently happen, and this is the most suitable way of practice. It is not the way of delay, or the one that will make one become addicted to samadhi, which is just the cause of slowness. In doing the investigation with panya, one must do it in the way that one is most adept, and the way that one most prefers. It can be done with any condition or object that can be found within the sphere of the Satchadhamma. Once one has understood any one object, then this understanding will diffuse to all the rest. One must force and concentrate the mind to remain with the body. One must really keep it in the body by taking this body as the fence, taking the skin as the wall. Force the citta to tour the inner and outer sides of the skin. Keep going along this wall. One then goes inside the wall, to the internal parts of the body, looking at the flesh, sinews, and bones. Looking at the liver, the kidneys, intestines, and stomach. Look at the new food and the old food, and look at the top, the bottom, and the middle part. If one looks in the light of Pratikula and Asupa, one sees nothing but filth and impurity. If one looks in terms of the elements, it is then just full of elements. It is not I, it is not mine. It is full of corruptions. It is not pleasant or beautiful, following the fancy of the kilesas, which like to fabricate things because they themselves are false. So whatever can match up with the kilesas must also be unreal. Beauty is fake, for it doesn't accord with the truth. Truly, is it really good looking? Is there any part of our body that is really beautiful? There is no such thing. But the kilesas like to imagine that there is, which goes contrary to the Dhamma of the Lord Buddha, which is real. As a result, they cause us to undergo dukkha, In doing the investigation, it is therefore necessary to force the citta to get into the various parts of the body, as they are all true in the aspect of asupa, or the elements, or anicjang, dukkhang, and anatta. One should investigate in the light of whatever aspect suits one's preference. When one investigates in the light of asupa, then it will lead one to the elements as a natural consequence. Or one can investigate in the light of any one of the tilakana, be it anicjang, dukkhang, or anatta. Or one can investigate all three of them together, as they are all interrelated. This is the investigation in the light of panya. In doing this investigation, if there happens to be the tendency to investigate the external objects, be it of any form or shape, using them as a basis of comparison and contrast, one can also investigate them in the same manner, for both the internal and the external are identical. How then can the citta become deluded? The outside is similar to the inside, and the internal resembles the external. So how can there be delusion or infatuation? The citta will now gradually calm down. The perception of beauty will now steadily diminish. One's whims and fancies about beauty will be steadily waning. After having repeatedly investigated until one attains to understanding and clear penetration, where all doubts are dispelled and all obscurity is shattered, then the uprooting of attachments and wrong views, which are the charlatans, will naturally happen by itself, as one draws inwards. This is due to the power of panya that has investigated until one can see clearly. This is what panya is all about. After having investigated with panya for some time, the citta can then become tired, as the citta has been doing so much work. The investigation in the light of panya is the work of the citta. This work of investigating, digging, searching, and analyzing is similar to the physical work of striking, cutting, digging, carrying, and shouldering a load. This is the work of the citta. After having toiled for some time, one can also become tired. One becomes weary inside, and the body becomes exhausted. It is not only the heart. Both the body and the heart become tired. This is then the time to take a rest in samadhi. When one wants to enter into the resting state, one should focus one's attention on any one particular Dhamma object. Keep the citta fixed and concentrated only on that Dhamma object, while paying no attention to anything else, except that Dhamma Parigama object, which one is using for the citta to concentrate upon. Then the flow of the citta will be gathered into a single point, and the citta will attain to calm. The Parigama object will then lose its significance, as the citta can now stand on its own, with the knowingness standing out distinctively, and the citta remaining in its natural state of stillness. This is the way it should be for one who has entered into calm, and whose citta has come to convergence. Once one becomes re-strengthened, then one should withdraw. However, while doing the investigation, one must never speculate or imagine, by fancying that things should be like this or like that. As one has envisioned from the beginning, one must now concentrate in the work of the present. Do not lose track of the investigation, but keep it going on perpetually. This is the way of doing the investigation. This is the elaboration of the ways and means which the practitioner can take up in any aspect to apply in his own practice in the way which suits his character and preference. Whatever kind of realization and experience arises, let it be one's own possession. Let the means and techniques of investigation be the ones that one devises up oneself, by extending and expanding the pointers given to us by our teacher. Then they will be entirely our own work, brought about by our own wisdom in the way that is most suitable for us. The investigation with Panya is endless. As long as the kilesas are not totally extinct, then the technique of Panya that is used in the work of thinking, examining, and analyzing for the overcoming and annihilation of the kilesas will still be there. Once one has got to the level of Mahasati and Mahapanya, then there will not be any good need to coerce Panya to do the work apart from holding it back. This is because it is incessantly turning round, and this is when the citta can become exhausted. The citta is weary, and the body is tired due to the lack of sleep. As the citta is now not happy with sleeping, but is only satisfied with the work of digging, searching, striking, and cutting down all the various kinds of kilesas for the sole purpose of true realization and insight. This is when one has to rein in the citta, keeping it from going to the extreme and passing beyond the bounds of propriety. When the body does any work, it becomes exhausted, and one must then take a rest, go to sleep, and take food, so that the body can become re-strengthened and be ready to do further work. When the citta becomes weakened and exhausted from doing a lot of work of investigation and analysis in the way of Panya, it must take a rest as well. The way to rest the citta is with the means of Samadhi Bhavana, so that the citta can attain to calm. This is the correct thing to do. It is conducive to ease and smoothness. I really like to hear my friends relating to me the results of their practice, and I would also like to see my friends realize and experience the things that I have discussed. I want them to find out exactly where these things are found. Who is going to be the one to realize them? Who is going to be the one to do the investigation? Who is going to be the one to cut down the kilesas? With whom are the kilesas found? What is the means of quelling the kilesas? How do they cease? And with what method are they extinguished? These are the things that one must get to see clearly for oneself. One should realize them clearly on one's own, which is far better than hearing it from one's teachers. This is one's own practice. Don't pay any attention to the affairs of the world and samsara. They are all the work of the kilesas. These kilesas have afflicted us with immense dukkha and torment for a long time. We shouldn't have any doubt about this, or think that we can become good, happy, and at ease by the kilesas dragging us or by our belief in the kilesas. We should always recollect the Lord Buddha, who at one time was also the storehouse of the kilesas, like all the rest of the world in general. The Lord had already experienced the results created by the kilesas. If he could have been noble with the work of the kilesas, then he wouldn't have been seeking for the Dhamma of deliverance that would enable him to attain to freedom from dukkha, thus arriving at the state of purity. He would instead have remained immersed in the world, like all the rest of living beings. We have to contemplate and compare the story of the Lord Buddha, so that it can serve as a moral lesson that will always remind us. There should not be any doubt among any of us here concerning the results brought out by the kilesas, whether it is about greed, hatred, delusion, or raga tanha, since we all have experienced them for such a long time. These are very familiar experiences, as they have always been found in the heart and been so deeply ingrained in it. There isn't a single moment that they are separated from the heart, even during the time of sleep. For during sleep, the kilesas merely calm down, instead of going out to do any work. When we go to sleep, the kilesas become themselves. And when we get up, they are also wide awake. It can be said that when we go to sleep, the kilesas also go to sleep, as they do not show themselves. And when we are completely sound asleep, the kilesas also do likewise. This is the inactivity of the kilesas at the time when we are sound asleep. Or we can say that the kilesas are also sound asleep. When we wake up, the kilesas are also awakened. Once they wake up, then they will go out through the sense doors, wandering around looking for nourishment in the different places. They go out through the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and body, and through thinking and imagining inside the heart, creating up Dhamma Ramana, which are all the activities of the kilesas. This is a normal thing for all ordinary people, without any exception. As long as the citta is not purified, we will never come across freedom. The source that produces all of the kilesas is the citta. Where does this production take place? The entrances and exits of the kilesas are the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, and heart. These are the places where all the activity is taking place. So at the same time, we must try to make the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, and heart the access ways for Dhamma, as the place which will produce the Magga, Phala, and Nibbana, the truth and Dhamma. The way that we are practicing Dhamma now is the way of changing the producer within, and to replace the one who goes out seeking gratification through the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and body. Now let us make Dhamma the one that goes out. Whatever we see, we will investigate in the light of Dhamma. Whatever we hear, we will investigate in the light of Dhamma. Always for the purpose of uprooting ourselves. This is when Dhamma is put to work, and the result of this work is happiness. When the kilesas do the work, the consequence of it is dukkha. Whatever we round in is all poison that ceaselessly burns the heart and afflicts it with trouble and hardship. The kilesas take no heed of time, or the race, creed, or color of people. The kilesas will always crush and ruin all of these people similarly. We have to try to bring about the change. The place to put the effort is right in the self-same citta. But we have to change the one who puts in the effort to go in the way of Dhamma. When we go out through the ways of the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and body, let it be under the influence of sati and panya. Wherever the citta goes, let panya be right behind it, following behind, doing the investigation to find out the reason, the cause and effect. We have to change the one who works inside and change the one who goes out to look for work. Make them all go in the way of Dhamma with vigilance. If it is dukkha, let's face it. Don't be deterred by dukkha, for it will obstruct the heart and cause it to be weakened and discouraged, which is just the tricks of the kilesas fooling us. If it is Dhamma, one will not be weak. If we follow the way of Dhamma, then we have to follow the way of reason and cause and effect. If it is the kilesas, then it is totally devoid of any reason, because the kilesas have a distaste and dislike for reason. They never give any attention to reason. They only go after their desire and craving. These are the things that the kilesas go after. They are the essence, the substance, and the life of the kilesas. If we like to speak in these terms, we can do so, because regardless of the types of the kilesas, they are all similar in this respect. So how can we be doubtful of the world once we have investigated in this way? The hearts of all people are the same. Every element aggregate that is brought together, having the kilesas, has the cause. Whatever shape or form it has, is accompanied by the good and bad results of past karma. Consequently, dukkha is unavoidable. How can the body escape from being the home of dukkha? The houses and buildings are not the habitat of dukkha. But this body is truly its abode. Dukkha is right here. Every piece and part of the body, with the exception of the hair, which can be cut off without any pain, can cause pain to arise, even the nails in those parts which are not already dead. This body is the home of all kinds of dukkha, or the aggregates of dukkha. Khanda means aggregate. That is, if we want to make a literary work of translation. But if we want to translate it so that we can get to the gist and truth of it, and to really understand the cause and effect relationship of dukkha, and for the purpose of eradicating the kilesas, then khanda is translated as group. What kind of aggregate is it? It is the aggregate of dukkha. Every one of them is dukkha. Rupa is dukkhaṁ, anicchaṁ, and anatta. And likewise with vedana, which is dukkhaṁ, anicchaṁ, and anatta. And it is similar with sanya, sankhara, and vijnana. They are all dukkhaṁ, anicchaṁ, and anatta. So how can they not be called aggregates of dukkha? And that is all there is to the five khandhas. The heart itself is also the home of dukkha. If sati and panya are not capable of cleansing these masses of dukkha, which are the products of the kilesas, so that they are totally got rid of, then the heart will always remain to be the aggregate of dukkha. The heart will never be able to transcend the mass of dukkha, and it will not be able to come up with clearness and purity if it is not cleansed and purified and assisted by its possessor, which is sati panya. Otherwise, we will never be able to find a way out of dukkha. So when we can clearly see with this reasoning, and as we are responsible for ourselves, how can we wait any longer? How can we remain weak, lazy, and expedient by taking the easy way out? In whatever way can get us through, we have to really struggle and drive ourselves to the last breath. If we should die, let us die struggling. If we don't die, let us arrive at the shore of freedom, the shore of Nibbana, befitting one who is a follower of the Tathagata, and who is not perplexed by this world, which is the realm of the cemetery, birth and death, all over it. As long as one is still overshadowed by the realm of birth, aging, sickness, and death, wherever one lives, one will never come across any satisfying happiness. Speculation and theory is not the truth, but the clear, penetrative realization and insight of all the Dhammas, including the truth of anicca, dukkha, and anatta, that pervades over the entire universe, is the truth without any doubt. Once one has investigated to this level, one will be totally free of doubt. One will now have the propensity to do the work of exertion and have a great time doing it. One will delight in contending with the kilesas by putting an all-out effort into it without being concerned about one's well-being, solely for the sake of deliverance. Once one has consolidated one's strength from the investigation of panya, the citta will now be powerful. No other power can be greater than that of the citta. There is none to be found in this world. The power of the citta is preeminent, and there is no other power that can be greater than that of panya. One must therefore strive in the development of panya. Don't be weak. Whatever position or posture one is in, and whatever requisite one is dispensing at that time, one must never neglect one's undertaking. One must never be heedless. Always be possessed with sati in yourselves. One must not have a craving appetite, and one's stomach should not be bigger than that of a human being. One's belly should have dhamma and someone to control it. One's mouth and tongue should be directed by sati and panya, and then they will be suitable to one's livelihood. They will be the suitable place to provide one's life process and body with nourishment. And for the cultivation of dhamma, that runs smoothly and with ease, without allowing the kilesas to infiltrate into them. This is the way to be with sati and panya. Your investigation must be thorough and meticulous, leaving no stones unturned. Then you will be following the way of one who is looking for wisdom. But otherwise, you will not be able to make it through. The development of wisdom depends on the inclination towards contemplation, investigation, reflection, and analysis. It should be done going back and forth, and devising up new tactics and strategies, just like the kilesas, which are extremely clever and crafty. They are cunning and many-sided. Our sati and panya must also be equally so that you can attain to bliss and experience happiness in accordance with the Dhamma taught by the Lord, that emanated from his heart. His aim and purpose was that all living beings should be happy and excel in the way of the heart, which is far more important than anything else, finally attaining to the total deliverance from dukkha, and arriving at the perfect happiness. As followers of the Tathagata, we have to strive on this path. We must take the Lord Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha as the vital principle within our hearts. We must not take up the kilesas that are hiding within our hearts, constantly crushing and damaging ourselves. We must never be complacent. Whatever we do, if we put in a lot of practice and training, we can gain expertise. Consider the boxers. How do they train themselves in the early stages? They kick and hit at the wind and at the sandbags. Next, they go into the ring and kick and hit at their opponents. When they become very skillful, they can become champions. It is likewise with the citta. When we put in a lot of training and practice, then we will be skillful at samadhi and become champions of samadhi. And when we get to the level of panya, then we will become skillful in panya and champions of panya. The citta will be incessantly turning around. This is when one is fully convinced of the magga, phala, and nibbana. One's conviction will be total and free of any doubt. And that is when the strength of the citta becomes formidable. One really puts in the effort without having any mercy for oneself. During that time, the body was very fit for the exertion in my own case. It was so energetic that it had to be restrained by fasting. This technique not only slowed down the body, but it also added to the smoothness of practice. There are two advantages to be had from fasting, and I have experienced this clearly within myself. When I went on fast, my practice of bhavana went on smoothly and efficiently, and very easily. The heart was really committed and determined, and it was this strength of heart that held sway over the body. The heart could only follow its own will, for the determination was so very intense. It wasn't concerned about how toilsome or difficult this exertion might be. All it wanted was to achieve. This dogged determination is of great power. One's diligent effort and strenuous exertion has to follow its direction. The crucial thing here is in one's aspiration. The intensity of one's desire for attainment and realization will clearly dictate to one just what the level of one's intensity of exertion will have to be. It will be very obvious to oneself, and one will have no doubt about this at all. One cannot remain still, because one is very eager and hopeful. With this kind of aspiration and resolve, one can do nothing but to put in an all-out effort. Looking at the way I am today, when the body has now run out of energy, how can one exert in that manner anymore? They are now two different worlds. This body is just about to crash. Though it is being assisted and propped up, it still tends to fall over. And the heart, which is the crucial point, no longer has that kind of determination. It has totally disappeared. It really has. The aspiration for the Magga, Pala, and Nibbana, and the desire to become an Arahant, have all totally faded away. They have entirely vanished. They have all unquestionably disappeared. So what else is there to seek for? What would be the purpose of such exertion? What could be the goal of one's resolve? There is none. If I had to do that kind of exertion today, I would not be able to do it. I would die first. I would drop dead even before I got started. Once the citta has reached the ultimate point, it will stop immediately. One sati and panya that had been turning around like a dhammacakka, both day and night, with the exception of during the time of sleep, will abruptly shut down, like the way they shut down machines in the factories. They can do it instantly. It is the same way with the citta, that instantaneously turns off. The work is completed. One is now a different person entirely. As soon as Mahasati and Mahapanya come to an abrupt stop, they then disappear, and one doesn't know where they go. This is because they used to turn around for the purpose of destruction. But now there is nothing else to be destroyed. All issues come to an end. Thereafter, one still does one's practice. But one does it as one pleases, and in the way that suits oneself. Whatever position of exertion it may be in, one just does it in the way that is suitable to oneself. It is not done under any control or discipline like before. There is no more coercion. Whenever one feels like walking jhankama, one just walks. And whenever one sits in samadhi, one just sits so that it is suitable to one's heart and body. Whenever they need it, then one puts in that practice. One does not do it with force or with any determination. The heart no longer acts in such a way that it can raise any questions within one's mind. One will not have to ask the question, how come it is like this again? This is how one comes to see the value of Dhamma. The Dhamma that has fully possessed the heart is of immeasurable value, a value that is beyond reckoning. At the same time, one also comes to see the harm of the gilesas that used to dominate over the heart, tyrannizing and afflicting the heart for countless kalpas. One can see this fully within one's heart. One fully sees both the harm of the mass of dukkha produced by the kilesas and the value of Dhamma brought about by the Magga, that imparts one with the satisfying Dhamma. What then is there to be doubtful about? What perplexity can there be? And what uncertainty? One can see all the virtual objects with one's eyes. All the sights, sounds, smells, tastes, and touches have existed since ancient times. It is we who imagine and fantasize about them when we come across them. When we see or hear things, or come into contact with anything, it is the citta that concocts up things and perpetually fools us by telling us that that is good or that is bad, or this is pretty and this is ugly, that this thing is charming and that thing is horrible. These are all the work of the khandhas, fooling us. All those things exist naturally as they are. They don't know what they are. It is the citta that is the chief of deception. It constantly fools us. The gilesas lead the deception, and we are deluded in them. We never see the harm of our imagination. It is only sati and panya that can see the damage of our fantasy and be the ones to catch up with the kilesas. As soon as the kilesas concoct up things, sati and panya will latch on to them. How can they deceive one anymore? One is now always capable of catching up with them. For instance, think about the tiger. As soon as they concoct up the image of a tiger, it then disappears. This tiger is none other than Sankhara. One can figure this out straight away. Think about beauty. When one sees a woman and one thinks that she is pretty, one will know immediately that the one that says that this thing is beautiful is within oneself. The object out there doesn't say anything about itself. This things are in their natural state of earth, water, air, and fire, and they are just a form or an image. It is the one in here that has the fantasy and that imagines that this thing is pretty. As soon as they concoct up, sati and panya will immediately know, and then they will cease, right away. This beauty is Sankhara. It is the one which deceives. The ugly one is really Sankhara. This is where one sees its harm. One doesn't see the value or the damage out there, and one doesn't think that the thing out there is lovely or charming. Once one has seen the harm here, where else can it go? This is the way that one gains insight. One knows that one is being fooled by them. The gilesas use the khandhas to fool us and bury our heads in the ground. You have to keep on doing this investigation. Do it until you can knock down the kilesas. Once you have vanquished them and eliminated them from the citta, and let Dhamma reign over the heart. Then you will experience true bliss and ease. Then the months, the years, the hours, and the minutes, and all forms of samuti will not be able to bother the heart, because the heart doesn't get involved with them. Previously, it was the kilesas that dragged the heart away to become entangled with them. But once the ones that involve the citta with them are no longer there, then the citta becomes itself. It becomes completely Dhamma. Where does one look or seek for Dhamma? Once one has come across the complete heart, then the questions of where the Dhamma is will disappear. Where is one going to look for it? For who is the one who has now realized the Dhamma? Who is the one that is experiencing it at the moment and abiding with it? What is the Dhamma? One knows this within one's heart. How then can one still be deluded? How can one now go and chase after shadows? Once one has caught the real thing, does one still go after its shadow or look for its tracks? The tracks now are with the thing itself. At first, we follow it by tracing its tracks, like tracing the tracks of an ox. Once we have caught up with the ox itself, then there is no need to trace its tracks anymore. Once one has arrived at the genuine Dhamma, then the pursuit by the various methods comes to an end. After following the traces of truth until arriving at the complete truth itself, then the chase is over. And that is all there is to it. As practitioners, you have to set up your hearts and your determination. When your train of thought goes in the way of the world and pierces and pokes at your heart like an arrow, you must immediately pull it out by reining in your thoughts, no matter how intense your desire to think might be. You have to understand that this is your enemy mounting an offensive. You must suppress these things. Don't ever cherish them. Then it will be possible for you to pass beyond them. You have to subdue them with sati and panya. Sati and panya will not only curb them, but they will also dig and search for them, rounding them up and striking them down. This is the way of one who takes care of himself and who wants to be free from harm and danger. As far as birth and death is concerned, one has experienced them long enough and has been completely chastised by them. One should have learned one's lesson by now. Wherever one is born, that is also where one dies. Wherever one takes birth, that is also where one goes through dukkha. Dukkha follows behind birth. Thus the Lord said, Dukkhaṃ nati acchā tassa. Dukkha, doesn't fall upon one who doesn't take up birth. Sankhara not only causes one to take up birth, but it also causes one to experience dukkha by its concocting. For this reason, dukkhaṃ nati acchātassa is applicable to both. That is, dukkha doesn't fall upon one who doesn't take up birth and existences. Next, we move inwards to the sankhara, which is samudaya. Once it is no longer possible for it to take birth, then it will cease. Taisang vupa samo sukho. The quelling and extinction of sankhara is the supreme happiness. This sankhara is the sankhara of samudaya. This is the principal one. It is now destroyed by the Dhamma Chaka, which is the Machima Patipada. Taisang vupa samo sukho. The quelling and extinction of sankhara is the supreme happiness. This quelling is done right here at the sankhara that does the concocting. This is the sankhara that is being forced by samudaya to concoct and fabricate, to imagine and create fantasies. But as far as this physical sankhara is concerned, how can we extinguish it, as it has already taken up birth? The true quelling is right in here. Once one has extinguished the internal sankhara, which is the samudaya, then this external sankhara, which is the body, is no problem. It just goes on wriggling and wriggling, like the severed tail of a lizard. When there is dukkha in the body, it only afflicts the body. Whatever happens to it, it just affects the body. It just wriggles and wriggles. Once we have fully comprehended its nature, then it is not a problem for us. It just goes on wriggling until the day of its dissolution. Thereafter, one will have laid down one's responsibility. One will not lose any worry or concern, because one will not have had any worry or concern for it anyway. One is not attached to or possessive of it, but one still has to be responsible for it. But when it finally disappears, then it is the end of the problem and one's responsibility. One remains complete and perfect without having to be involved with any kind of samuti. End of Desana.